I'm Ralph Gehrke, and the topic I'd like to present to you, and then hope that we can have some discussion on it, is attempts at social reform in ancient Israel. The reason why, there are several reasons why it's on the agenda tonight. We, as staff people, were asked to send in, must have been last May, April, I think, several topics outside of our main work in which we might give lectures. And I suggested several, and then I think it was Elmer chose this one. It's kind of nice that it was on Labor Day. We talked about justice and reform and things like that, and that's perhaps his reason. And I'm very happy to present it. I should say that this was written originally. It's gone through a couple of revisions. Hasn't been published yet, but might be published sometime. When I was living in Chicago, and I think it would be true to say that a black activist by the name of Fred Hampton was the person responsible for my study. I was teaching at Concordia Teachers College, and in the whole civil rights movement, this was even after the peak of it, this man, some of you might know, was murdered by the Chicago police. He had appeared in a most provocative way before our Lutheran Human Relations Group, which was trying to understand these great problems for the church in the suburbs. And I can remember that one of the things that he challenged throughout is a challenge to all of us. Is a challenge that you have to give us land. Even those that served in the Civil War were supposed to get 40 acres and a mule and never got it because they were black. And I guess then, as an Old Testament professor, I simply said, what was the situation? I knew a little about it, but I never really studied it systematically in ancient Israel as far as land, because in that society, agricultural society, land was the important thing. It was the basis of their economic life. And I found it quite an interesting study. I won't present to you all of the things that I did in my research. That isn't necessary. But I think what I might present, first of all, is the system of land tenure. It's kind of interesting in ancient Israel. So let's start out with something basic. First of all, I think that as I studied this, I found out that this was a very live thing in the mind of every Israelite, that the land belonged to the Lord. This idea that we have of private property or something like that, that was not at all in ancient Israel. In the evening, around a campfire, when parents, grandparents, the elder of the clan, maybe the best storyteller in the village, would tell the stories of their people, they would refer to landmarks, and Israel is a very small country even today. And you travel around it, and people will point out there's hardly a hill that doesn't have some story connected with it. And for instance, one of the big landmarks, and even to modern Israel, is the first piece of land that they ever, property that the Israelites ever got in this land. Because you remember when the patriarchs came, it was really Canaanites, people who were possessing it, their enemies. And so all the people, as they grew up, realized that this land hadn't belonged to them. And that Abraham first bought the cave of Machpelah to bury his wife in. And to this day, some of you might know that in the Six-Day War, Golda Meir asked her stormtroopers to take two places first, I lost a lot of fine Jewish officers in doing it, paratroopers. One was the Wailing Wall, the other one was the Cave of Machpelah. And the 6 o'clock news, you could see it if you knew what you were seeing. Now the old rabbis carrying the Torah and dancing a city dance of joy because they had not only this Wailing Wall, the last part of the temple, but the Cave of Machpelah, the first rites. Then, of course, the stories were told, they weren't written down yet at this time, of Joshua's conquest of the land. But whenever they told the stories of the Holy War, they told the story that their God, the Lord, Yahweh, we can call him, because that's his personal name in Hebrew, had, like a giant warrior, been with the troops in taking it. And since he had done the real fighting, the land belonged to him. In fact, it's called a number of places in the Bible, the land of Yahweh, the domain of Yahweh. In fact, the Lord himself puts it in Leviticus 25:23, in the case of some legislation in which you were not permitted to sell your own land, even if you were poverty-stricken. You might, in order to get money and feed your family, you might try to sell it. You were not able to do that in perpetuity. Land must not be sold in perpetuity, for the land belongs to me. And to me you are only strangers and guests. That meant that no family in ancient Israel would ever lose the economic basis of their livelihood. Even if they had bad crops, or if they blew it. Does anyone know the system that they had of getting the land back? The extended family did. What?
Every seventh year.
Seventh year? And also?
The Jubilee
year. Yes, later the Jubilee year. Mm-hmm, correct. And also this idea of a redeemer. Do you remember that? A rich man like Boaz would have to help a poor widow. Remember, like Naomi, when she comes back, all the men have died in the family, and you're going to have that lined up. In other words, there's a little more to it. I'm leaving something out here. When Joshua had conquered, or at least the foothold in the main part, what they did is allotted all of the sections of the land to the various tribes, to the various clans, to the various families. They did that by sacred lot. We don't know the whole story. We know that, for instance, the tribe of Joseph, in chapter 17 of Joshua, said it was too small a portion for their large tribe. They wanted more. So they had intertribal rivalries, just like anything else. But somehow, once it was settled in the name of God by allotment, this was very important. And even though they would go through the economic straits, and certainly some people prospered and some people didn't, some people were lazy and some people weren't, the extended family took care of that. I've seen this in New Guinea. New Guinea had, until now we westernized it, the old tribal customs of land tenure. And now what we've done, a terrible sort of thing, is to introduce the modern Western ideas of private property. It'll take a long time for that to take root, but this is a very similar sort of thing. If you read in the Bible, for instance, in the book of Joshua, there are a lot of chapters, I think it's 13 or 21, that have just names of geography, and most people just go past it, and especially modern people, they got these nice maps, animated maps, and they say, oh, look, that's where this tribe is, and that's where this is, and all that. That's not the way to read it. You've got to see it from the inside, that everybody realized this is our land. This was given to our ancestors. And you can see the boundaries, and they know where those boundaries are. In fact, they're so accurate that sometimes we can't even find the boundaries because they knew much more about the topography than we do. And if you read what the book of Joshua says at this point, I think I have it here, quote, when Joshua was done with this allotment, it says, the children of Israel took possession of this land and settled Yahweh had given all their enemies into their hands, and of all the promises that Yahweh, that's the Lord, had made to the house of Israel, not one failed. All were fulfilled. The pragmatic fact is that all they had is was a foothold in the hills. And the Canaanites owned all of the other most important sections. But in faith, they would finally get this land. And now they didn't only fight holy wars. This took a long time, and they never really got all of it until David finally conquered the whole business. It took a long time before they could themselves take all of it. Let me give you an idea of what they did. If you had the first fruits, by the way, this is common in all cultures. The Indians on the coast here of the Pacific Northwest would never think of taking the first of their catch without giving the first fruits to the deity. Who had the fish god, you see that, a deity. You did that hunting, you did that in all these things. And the Israelites would do this, but interesting, we have a little, it's in Deuteronomy 26, a little liturgy that when they brought the first fruits, the farmer had to put it, the first fruits, let's say, of his orchard, of his vineyard, put it in a basket and bring it to the Lord. He had to touch the altar and he had to recite what scholars call a brief historical creed. Something like this. Article number one. The Lord guided the nomadic ancestors. This would be especially Jacob. Article two. When they went down into Egypt, even though they were oppressed, the Lord delivered them. Article three, like we have three articles in the Christian creed, is that the Lord brought them into the land and gave them this land. And now this is interesting. And then he said, He, Yahweh, brought us to this place, gave us this land, a land where milk and honey flow. And behold, now I'm giving you the fruit of the ground, which thou, O Lord, hast given me. So what I'm trying to say here is that they had many institutions which made it clear to them that though this had been allotted to them by the Lord, it was only somewhat temporary. It really belonged to him, and they had it only as long as he gave it to them. And as some of you mentioned, we have had this goal. We have an awful lot of legislation. Let me just read a few of them. I can't read all of this here. See, most of their system of justice, administration of justice, was done in the village. When I lived in New Guinea, I saw that. If they had something that had to be settled, they settled it right then and there, under the open sky. Didn't have any lawyers or any judges or anything like that. And that's the way it was in ancient Israel. The elders at the gate, well, that would be the open spot where people came together, they would settle it. And you have laws like this. Listen to this. If you lend money to any of my people, of you who is poor, you shall not be to him as a creditor. You shall not exact interest from him. Do you hear that? That's what our whole economy is built on. If you ever take your neighbor's garment in pledge, so even if you've got a garnishee, and this is the, not the t-shirt that they wore, or their BVDs, but this is their suit. It's a long, they didn't have our tailor stuff, you know, for cutting these big shoulders and all the rest of it. But it was like a sleeping bag. In fact, they slept in it. And here it actually says, if you take your neighbor's garment in pledge, you shall restore it to him before the sun goes down. For it is his only covering. It's his mantle for his body. In what else shall he sleep? And in one of the variant passages, it simply says that if that person cries to the Lord has very sensitive ears to such a person or to a widow, or fatherless person, and he will listen. Reminds me when I was in prep school and we didn't want to study Latin. It was the middle of the Depression, studying for the ministry. And those old professors said, yes, here you are goofing off again. And the widows and the orphans are paying for your education. And here you are goofing off. And so we didn't like to study Latin, but we knew for the sake of the widows and the orphans we had to do that. If you read through the Old Testament, you will see this is a theme that comes throughout. If, for instance, it was too difficult a case for the village elders to settle any of these things, you could appeal it. Where did you appeal in those days? What was the Supreme Court?
Priest.
Pardon?
The priest.
The priest in either the local sanctuary or after the thing was unified in Jerusalem or wherever the main sanctuary was. Yeah. In other words, if anything is too difficult, it says just that word, then you could appeal your case. If you thought you were getting a raw deal, you could appeal your case to Supreme Court. And you could go there, and you could argue it. And then when the answer came back, it wasn't like this. If this happens, then this is what you do. It was always in the name of the Lord. And you would have such a thing like this. You shall not cheat any poor man of his rights at law. Or here's another one. When you reap your harvest and have forgotten the sheaf in the field, you shall not go back to get it. It shall be there for the sojourner, for the fatherless, for the widow, that the Lord may prosper you in the work of your hand. So in other words, there was an ongoing sense of justice. I'm afraid that I hope that you are listening and comparing this to our sin. I think some of you are comparing it to our way of having justice in our land tenure. And I don't mean that we don't have any justice in the United States, not at all. But I do think that this is, especially for us as Christian people, we sometimes down the Old Testament, saying it doesn't mean anything. New Testament is so much better, you see that. I just wonder whether we even come close to what's in the Old Testament here. Do you know that they had a covenant renewal festival? Now there's argument among scholars. Some think it was every Feast of the Tabernacles, that's in the fall of the year. When the elders would gather together, they would renew the covenant. Some think they did it every 7 years. Well, no matter, that's a dispute because there are, well, the text can be interpreted various ways. But one thing is clear, that say even long before David united everything and put them in the big time, when they would gather, they gathered at Shechem. That's the center of the land. It's called, in Judges 9, the belly button of the land, the center of the land. And there they actually, between Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal, they put the people there, and they simply, we hardly ever do that liturgically, make the people say amen to God's commands. And then at the end they had the blessings from Mount Gerizim and the curses on the people from Mount Ebal. And in other words, this was brought up to date all the time. And let me give you some examples of some of the things that were given to them when you had this. For instance, Deuteronomy 27, cursed be he who displaces his neighbor's boundary mark. And all the people will say, amen. In other words, some rich person that takes away the boundary mark and takes over that land, he comes underneath whose curse? God's curse, you see that? Cursed be he who tampers with the rights of the stranger. That means what? The alien, the fellow who doesn't have any rights here. The orphan or the widow. And all the people shall say amen. Look through that section if you ever want to, and you just see that this was a living sort of thing. Now, one more thing yet on this. When these laws were promulgated, They were part and parcel of the covenant. So often people today say, you heard it, the Ten Commandments are only the moral law of God. The ceremonial law doesn't apply to us. We can do anything we please. And we're New Testament Christians. And the other laws are political laws. You've heard that, haven't you? And then we don't take the Old Testament as the Word of God, which is very interesting what we do with the Old Testament. I don't think we're a theocracy like ancient Israel, but certainly these things can't be just thrown away, because any one of these stipulations was equivalent to the first commandment. In other words, the first commandment says, thou shalt have no other gods but me. And if anyone has another god, then he will break these commandments. I suppose, and I'm going to skip some of the material here, but I think this is enough here, simply say that among the ancient Israelites, there was a good social system, social justice. I suppose we're not without social justice. But I think that this invites comparison. And especially, I just don't know what's happened to us in the United States right now. It's the devil take the hindmost, and the quick money people, and the privatization of all these things, that you'd almost think that we had never had social legislation. And I'm afraid this may slip from us underneath the pressure of, here's a big word, militarization. And that's what happened in ancient Israel. It came the monarchy. Does anybody know why did they want to have a king? The Lord was their king, wasn't it? First time when they asked for a king, they asked Samuel. Samuel complained. He said, well, look, I've been leader of this people for how many years, and now that I'm old and gray, they will throw me out. Remember what the Lord said to him? They aren't trying to throw you out from leadership. They're throwing me out, isn't it? Nevertheless, this is interesting. Negotiate with them. The Hebrew word there is hearken. Give them a hearing. And Samuel set up the first king. Who was the first king?
Saul.
Proved to be a fizzle, didn't he? Because he had the wrong idea of kingship. Sought for prerogatives that belong only to God. By the way, I might say that Samuel first protested before they actually elected the king. Many of you know that. 1 Samuel 8, he simply says, if you've got a king, he will take, he will take, he will take. And this is what it says here. I think I have it in my notes here. He will take the best of your fields and your vineyards and your olive orchards, and he'll give them to your servants. He'll take a tenth of your grain and your vineyards, give it to his officers. In other words, you're going to get rid of the time, you want to fight the Philistines and beat them, you're going to have an army. And you're going to have to really fight it out. And he will take the tenth of your flocks, and you will be his slaves. And that day you'll cry out because of your king whom you have chosen for yourself, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. Well, I give old Samuel credit that he tried to make an Israelite kingship out of this. I like to call this the Samuel Compromise. So that it wouldn't be, because a king, that word melech, you shouldn't even say it. You should say only K-I-N-G. In fact, through the early parts of this section, the only thing that they call him a nagid in Hebrew, he's only kind of a leader, because the word melech sounds like all the Canaanites and all the Egyptians, where a king was a divine person. You see that? And now we come to David. Nothing succeeds like success, ladies and gentlemen. And what did David do? He put him on the map, didn't he? He not only united the north and the south, he created an empire and conquered Jerusalem and put everything there. And now it was established. Marvelous thing about David is that what? What's the marvelous thing about David? You compare him, say, to Saul.
He had God's approval.
Yes, and he was in a different situation. They aren't fighting holy wars anymore, and so he gets much better marks. I don't know whether he deserves them, but he's judged by a different standard than Saul. By the old Saul, standard of the holy war, Saul fell down. By the new standard of the new age, David wins. And he even gets a promise. Although I must say that, and there's more evidence on David than anyone else in the Bible except Jeremiah, that David seems to be a person that, at least when the prophets stand up to him, listens. Doesn't always try to put all kinds of excuses. Saul tried to do that. Really surprising. And of course, isn't it interesting what God makes of this whole thing? That he gives the promise to David's dynasty, isn't it? That from him would come the king who would really reign in righteousness and fulfill everything that was never fulfilled otherwise. A worldwide rule for all time and all space. That's kind of a surprising thing. So that's why I say this is a big thing, but there's no doubt about it that with this new setup, the old system is falling apart. David tried to change the tribal boundaries himself. Read it in 2 Samuel 24. A plague came and stopped it. Never went on. But Solomon, his son, carried it right straight through. And all the rest did. They simply changed these tribal boundaries. And they took these things away. And now we come finally to... You see, I'm telling a rather sad story here. But I think it has to be told. Were there any attempts at Reformation? Well, there were a few revolutions, but usually revolutions don't help very much. Because the revolutionists, there was one by the name of Jehu, was very unjust himself. And when he was done killing his predecessors, murdering them, the whole kingdom was in a very, very bad state. It was exhausted. I wouldn't call that a reform. But what does happen now, as soon as you've got kings, the Lord raises what I'd like to call emergency measures, and those are prophets. Who is the prophet who stood up against David?
Nathan.
Who's the prophet that stood up against, say, Ahaz?
Elijah.
Yeah, Isaiah. And who is the prophet who stood up against, say, Jehoiakim? Jeremiah. If you've got a king, or let's say, for instance, over against Jeroboam the First, you've got Amos. Now, individual prophets stood up against individual kings, no question about that. But who is a true prophet and who's a false prophet? How do you know that? Is there a litmus paper by which you can tell them as some got white hats? Does anybody know what Jeremiah once saw, how you can tell the difference between a true prophet and a false prophet? This is chapter 28 of Jeremiah. Because they were always there. They were always two messages. You never knew. You always had to make choices there.
I remember, right, he said you just have to wait and see.
You're right. If it's a promise of salvation, you have to wait and see. If it's a promise of doom, it's true. Yes, don't you remember that Hananiah was a false prophet? He turned out, he's not called a false prophet in the Bible. I said that. He's called a prophet. And when Jeremiah had his run-in with him, and, what was it? Hananiah said, all the people who were sent away under Nebuchadnezzar's first raid, they'll come back in 2 years. Everything will be just fine. Do you know what Jeremiah said to that prophecy? He said what you must say to a prophecy. You must say, Amen. He said, Amen. To a prophecy he didn't like. But then he said to him, You and I stand in tradition, Hananiah, of doom prophecy. And all the prophets who have prophesied doom and trouble have turned out to be true prophets. If it's a prophecy of salvation, you have to wait till it comes. Then you can be sure. Then after some time, the prophet didn't know himself to control this. The word of the Lord came to Jeremiah. And then, though they had taken off the yokes and broken them of wood, he put yokes of iron. That's just one of those things. Let's just take something, get back to our theme of property. You remember Naboth was a farmer, very wealthy and a very pious farmer. He had a vineyard, remember that? And what happened in that case? Why didn't he want to trade his vineyard for a better vineyard that King Ahab would give him?
Because it was of his ancestors.
Pardon?
It was of his ancestors, and it was not.
Yes, God forbid that I should take the inheritance of my fathers. And you see, that's that holy thing. The king wanted to consolidate his property. And, well, Jezebel says, that isn't the way we do it up there in Canaan, in the north, in Tyre. And she got her stooges up there, and they finally got rid of the guy. You see that? And that's that. There's a good case of an old-fashioned farmer wanting to hold on to the old ideas. And the king simply doing that. I don't know if any of you know that I translated this book by Hans Walter Wolf called, in German it's called Mit Micha Reden, Conversations with the Prophet Micah. Has any of you seen it? It's published by Fortress. It's called, I don't like the title they gave it, it's called Micah the Prophet. And I myself didn't know that prophet very much, but Professor Wolf, who lectured here in Holden about 4 years ago, when they had the Holden conference here, he was my teacher in Heidelberg, and so I was glad to translate it. It is really an astounding picture of what simply went wrong. It's also preaching both good news and bad news like these prophets. They didn't only preach doom, you see that? They preached salvation. They had hope when nobody else would have hope, you see that? I'm afraid too often today in the popular language, people as a prophet is just what? Person that tells the future, isn't it? Do you know who the prophet was before he talked about doom? A prophet was an intercessor, and if you look in the book of Amos, you might remember that the first time when the plagues of grasshoppers came and ate up all the crops, that Amos got on his knees and said, "Oh Lord, forgive. How can Jacob stand? He is so small." And the Lord forgave. And I don't know whether seagulls came or what, like in Utah. And he had all the grasshoppers or what. That was done. So a prophet is an intercessor. The next time when it happened, is I think there was a drought. The fire burned everything and the crops didn't come. And he did the same thing. He said, "Lord, forgive." When the third thing came, the plumb line that he saw, then the... "What do you see in Amos?" And he says, "I see a plumb line." and then the Lord says, "Yes, I'm putting a plumb line in the midst of the people, and I don't want you to get down on your knees this time, because I've had it. And I'm putting the plumb line next to the wall of the people, and that's a bad wall. What do? You tear it down." See what is now happening? The people just don't give doom to an individual king. They give doom to the whole people. The whole thing's going down the drain. The whole covenant's going to be gone. Could be like any other nation. Sounds like Matthew 23, 24, 25. It's a tremendous thing that these prophets do. And I think that they don't do that. The first they intercede. And you have whole sections And Amos is one of the toughest of all of them, where he simply asks the people, pleads with them, to listen and to have righteousness, hate evil, love good, establish justice in the gates. It may be that Yahweh will be gracious to the remnant of Joseph. Still might still do it. Well, this struggle went on, as you know. Each individual prophet lost. But then the Lord raised up another prophet. That prophet lose. And they'd all say, the avalanche is coming. People didn't believe it. Especially not the people who had power. But after the avalanche came, and that came in the form of Nebuchadnezzar, the only people who had a message were the prophets. They had a message. You see that especially in Jeremiah. To me, he's the greatest of all prophets. We all have favorites, you know. And he saw this, but he saw beyond just the doom. And he paid a terrible personal price for this. You read his confessions or his diary. Does anybody know the worst thing that he ever did in his confessions? Some of you know that. He cursed the day in which he was born. Well, if you curse your birthday, what are you doing? You're diving pretty close to the bottom of the pool, isn't it? And break your neck. At the same time, that same prophet, though he had to go through hell and high water to give this message that nobody wanted to hear, is the prophet who speaks of the new covenant. One of the greatest of the promises in the Old Testament, Jeremiah 31:31. Behold, the days are coming, saith the Lord, when I'll make a new covenant with the house of Jacob. Not according to the covenant which I made when I brought them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they broke, though I was a husband to them. But this will be my covenant. I'll put my Torah, my law, my instruction in their hearts. And they will no longer, any man, say to his neighbor, know the Lord. You won't have to have intermediaries, because they will all know my Lord. And I'll forgive their iniquity, I'll remember their sin no more. Well, you might think that that would be the great thing. And I suppose in a way it was. There was, and I forgot to mention that, there was one attempt by King Josiah to have a reformation. In other words, it was 2 minutes to midnight. And King Josiah, they found in the temple a book of the law, maybe our present book of Deuteronomy, at least the theses of the present book of Deuteronomy and of his reformation are very similar. So most people call this the book, the Deuteronomic Reformation. Most people, I think, give Josiah the credit for it. I think what you must give his credit to is a whole prophetic movement, because despite the fact that the prophets had trouble, there was still a movement going on. You see that? He was only 8 years old when his father died, and he himself, they could have put his brother on the throne, but they wanted to have someone, in other words, the regents who would take care of this young king, wanted to have a reformer, and they did. And he started to reform. And as soon as he found that, the high priest, they were reconstructing the temple, and they found this scroll. He read it, he took it very seriously, and he started this reform. And the reform was that there should, especially in Jerusalem, be the worship of only one God, none of this idolatry that had been creeping in. And it had to be done in only one place, in Jerusalem. No shedding of blood anywhere else, they could control it in Jerusalem. By one clergy, and that was the Zadokite blue blood clergy. Minor clergy couldn't touch it anymore from this time on. Does anybody know why this reformation failed? Of King Josiah? It really started out well. A lot of people thought he was going to be like he was from the line of David, you know, he was going to be the Messiah, the great one who would bring in justice. No, I think at this point that for once the priests and the Levites were with him, and they were actually went out. The Levites themselves, the minor clergymen, cooperated here and went out into the boondocks and preached to the people. Do you see that? And then he more or less gave them a chance to come in because they had lost their rights to have the sacrifices out in the boondocks. They could do that in the sanctuary place at Jerusalem. So he did centralize the worship, but that was in order to control it. Do you see that? So that it would be controlled. No, he was killed like John F. Kennedy, not in Dallas, but at Megiddo. He simply went up there. The king of Egypt came through, and it was a Pharaoh Necho. And he said, "Get out of my way." And even a king of Israel, he was a substantial king, couldn't stand up to a Pharaoh of Egypt. He tried to stand there in the way, and he was killed. He brought his body back to Jerusalem in the funeral procession. And the prophet Jeremiah met the funeral procession and said, "Don't weep for the dead king. Weep for the living king, because you'll see him today, and after that you will see him no more." And that's precisely what happened. Pharaoh Necho asked them to give the new king that they had put on the throne. They had a quickie coronation there. And says, "Give him to me to be a hostage to take down to Egypt to control the people." You see that? So everything kind of went down the drain. And the older brother who was very wicked, his name is Jehoiakim, he's really tough. They bypassed him purposely. He was put on the throne. So that meant the Reformation just didn't work. And by the way, some of you were saying about the law of the 7 years. The earlier law had said that you were supposed to have a Sabbath not only for the slaves, you know, that became enslaved, but for the ground, for the orchards, for everything. And we don't know. It seems that happened to be whenever you took over the orchard or whenever you took over this. Now, from this time forth, there was a lot of social legislation. It had to be at one time. You read it in the book of Deuteronomy. In other words, he tried to put all of these things together. But I'm afraid the book of Deuteronomy is still in the Bible. As far as actual functioning, it was a dead letter. It was never put in force. I think it's still there, and it was wonderful. So if King Josiah died, it was a tragedy, but one thing he still had is a group of reform-minded people. Do you see that? And Jeremiah could do that so that when now finally the Babylonians really meant business, they had enough of this rebellion, and they destroyed Jerusalem, and they carried away all. First, they didn't carry the first, they only carried the blue bloods, the main priests and the royal house. Next time they carried all property people away to exile. They didn't carry everybody. Notice what I said? All property people. So the very people who were making it were the people who lost it. And they're pretty wise. They gave that property to their stooges, Babylonian collaborators. That's what happens. And the people went to exile. Never thought they would get back. Perhaps the biggest influence of getting them back was, again, that of the prophets. You have the prophet to the exiles, whose collection of all his sayings in chapters 40 to 55 in the book of the prophet Isaiah gives them marvelous help, tells them they're going to come back, and that Cyrus the Persian will give them a chance. And they do come back. Not all of them. They start over. With Persian help, they set up. And here comes the Jubilee. Some of you mentioned Jubilee. Now, but that's another dead letter. I'm sorry to say that, ladies and gentlemen. This was not a real Reformation. In fact, most of the people were pretty well disenchanted. A good share of them never came back. It's like in modern Israel. Have all the Israelis gone back to Israel? No. Ben-Gurion and Golan Meir said there's no place for a Jew to live but where? In Israel. But they don't listen. They stay in Chicago or wherever they are, in New York. And so this was a halfway measure. And see, instead of doing this every 7 years, what did they do? They said, okay, it doesn't quite work to do it every 7 years, we'll do it every 50 years, you see. 7 times 7. That was the deadest of all dead letters. It's in the Bible, but it was never really a function, you see that. Now some people feel that the year of the Jubilee is announced by Jesus in the New Testament. And they, Mark watched all these times of Jubilee, so when he says, this is the acceptable year of the Lord, that's part of that Jubilee, but that's a New Testament sort of thing. As far as the Old Testament is concerned, they came back, and then they had a temple community. You might say it was a sacred place for Jews. And for a little while, they even under the Maccabees had independence, but that blew up, and then it didn't take long, and the Romans came, you see, they took the whole thing. Well, I've done my duty. Now I'll let you do your duty. I said that there were a number of attempts for social reform. And I guess I really have to say that none of them really have accomplished anything. We have a new thing in the modern state of Israel. After all those years, now finally they have a chance to establish justice, righteousness. And they had been a religious group before. Now they're a nation, and they have to do all the things that a nation does, including fighting wars. And the rabbis, Six-Day War, what did they do? Ride in the tanks on the Sabbath day, dig trenches on the Sabbath day because it was a holy war. Now, I don't think we have to talk about that. They'll have to take care of their own affairs, and they have trouble running their country, as you well know. But I think that the focus that we might have is what might this mean? This history, and I think I've pretty well given you the main things.
They go on strikes there too in modern Israel. LL was out for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, their economy, everything else. And I don't think that even if they got even more help from us than they do get, and they do get a tremendous amount, that would be the end of their problems. It's just hard to run a modern state, that's all. Especially if you've got 100 million Arabs around, don't you?
Is it that same attitude toward the land that motivated Menachem Begin to be so hot-headed about the West Bank? Is it that same?
I think so. Then you have, of course, you have even more extremists now, an American rabbi, Kahane.
Yeah, he wants to run the Arabs.
Well, but Begin did almost the same thing. When people ask him in a news conference, I saw this on TV, what about the Arabs? And he just made a motion like this. So there's not much difference, you see that?
Yeah,
but I think you must realize, though, that in his case he doesn't see that. But I think that I would be willing to let the Jewish people take this because we Gentiles have had enough problems in our mistreating of the Jews to just go at it from that angle. You see what I mean? I think that they will. And I think there are voices in Israel for justice, you see that? I don't think that they have to come from the Gentile community. That's what I'm saying. Here's my question. I'm going to be even a little pushy here, just simply. We're supposed to end up in time, aren't we? We have 10 minutes yet. Do we do it any better? Well, then what is this new covenant? Someone else, you had your hand raised. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I had my question had to do with the relationship between the Ten Commandments and these laws from Deuteronomy. Was it that the Ten Commandments were too vague? And these provide a more structure for ordering community life? Is that why?
Yeah, well, let's see. I think the Ten Commandments, you might say, is a kind of a first installment, you know what I mean? And then they are continually upgraded and brought into other areas, refined. The basic commandment, we all agree, is thou shalt have no other God before me. And if you take high interest from the poor, then you have another God except the Lord. You see that? Mm-hmm. You're breaking his covenant. Mm-hmm.
I was thinking of a contemporary analogy would be the Constitution as opposed to all of the laws that we have.
Mm-hmm.
That, yeah. I guess there's justification somewhere in the connection between what Congress does and what the Constitution says, although to read the Constitution is like reading the Ten Commandments. It's a very simple document and seemingly very...
And the other is an elaboration. Yes, I think that's a good analogy. Yes, correct. I suppose the big question really behind your question might be, I don't know if you meant that, is what about us in the Ten Commandments? You see that? We have kind of used the Ten Commandments, and I haven't anything against that, to express the will of God catechetically, you know, in all the catechisms. Luther wasn't the first one to do that. That's an old tradition in Christianity. Or what about us in... I read you a number of these laws. I didn't try to be exhaustive on that. What about us? Do we just simply say, well, that only has to do with the Jews? Is this not the word of God to us? Or how do we do that? I'm only raising questions here, not giving answers.
Well, the concept of justice, Dan, just a matter of what method you're going to use to achieve justice. And you had the 7 years, and you had the Jubilee, which didn't work, or it wasn't really enforced. But God is on the side of justice.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't get around that.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Well, the purpose of all these laws was to have obedience to God. And they proved that they could not live up to the law. There was no one that could live up to all the laws. They were in impossible situations, so it was sin.
Well, this is to show that we forgot ourselves. We can't do it ourselves.
What you're kind of saying, both of you, is that by the law there is no salvation to poor Paul. both of you are kind of saying that. But I think once you travel this law, this road from law to the gospel, that's what the road that you're traveling, don't you also then have to travel the road from the gospel to the law? In other words, are there instructions also for us in the new covenant? Or can we just kind of play free and easy because we don't just have the Old Testament set up? I realize that there's something new that has come, you see. All right, help us not only personally, but will he help us also to achieve justice?
I think so.
Pardon?
I think so.
You think so?
Will he achieve it for us, or does he expect us to be his agents to achieve it?
I think that's a very crucial question.
We don't achieve it to receive salvation. We have salvation. We are redeemed. But because we are redeemed, we are also responsible creatures. And if we take the place of Matthew, I believe it is, from the standpoint of the last judgment scene, to what the least of these my brother did for me, we just can't get by saying, well, he redeemed us, and he'll take care of us. He redeemed us, and he'll also make us responsible creatures. And I think Luther said, God's kingdom comes in the degree to which we meet our neighbor's need. See, God doesn't need anything. He has everything. And what we can show our love to God is by showing our love to our neighbor. By showing justice to our neighbor.
And love God with all your heart and mind in the first place. First we love God, then we love people and ourselves.
And if we love God, we love our neighbor.
Yes, and ourselves.
And if we don't love our neighbor, we don't love our God. He said, "How can you?" He said, "Jesus, how can you say you love God if you don't love your brother, whom you see?"
The church has been very active in seeking justice in some areas and very successful. One area it seems to me that the church has been negligent is in the area of justice for the rights of women. Tonight, as I was listening to Vespers, I was reminded of the fact that we, at least I didn't hear any mention, and it was in my heart, I guess, that women make, in our society, women earn less than 60 cents for every dollar that a man makes. So there's obviously injustice for women in our society. Now, we know that when Jesus came, he elevated the role of women as no one else in his society had done. We also know that in the Old Testament, there was a special provision made for widows and orphans. Obviously, half of the orphans probably were girls. But aside from that, what provision for justice for women was made, especially for women? I'm not familiar enough to be aware.
Yes, sure.
Well, I remember mothers bringing their babies, and they were blessed, and the disciples said, "Well, why do you want to bother with that?" You see, he did elevate children.
Jesus did, but I'm asking
yes.
about the Old Testament.
Yeah, he's asking a question about the Old Testament.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. I'm afraid that there are few little indications of, Genesis 1 would be perhaps the best one, that God created humans in his own image, male and female. There's a real equality there. Women are not the counterpart of the male, you see that. I think that would be a very strong place. But in the legislation, no, I think the legislation leaves a lot to be desired, you see that. And so in a sense, we have to take that seriously, that somehow something failed there, you see that. But I guess my big question is the church, are we as Christians doing any better? Maybe we are. Maybe the role of women is better. I know I was in that time in New Guinea. I guess that convinced me that the role of women was really elevated tremendously in Native society by the coming of the gospel. You would just see it. You've been out to the villages and hear the crying and the shouting and the fighting. You just have to be around there. And it's just terrible what women suffer in Native society, including societies that have been somewhat Christianized. At the same time, when you hear, I think it was one of the most interesting things I ever heard, I went to a conference of seminary, I went with our seminarians and the tertiary schools, and there were a lot of people thought that this conference would be against the missions, because missions have made mistakes, you see that, tremendous mistakes. And some of the girls were very, very angry at what the missions had done in curtailing their sexuality, cooping them up to mission schools and all this and that. Both Roman Catholics and Lutherans are largely what the missions were there. And at the same time, these very same people were very, very grateful for the coming of it, to see that. I think you can argue along those lines, but that goes only so far. You see what I mean? It's kind of a cultural sort of thing. And you put your finger on it. What are we doing in our own society? And there are many other whole issues that can be raised here. How does the church reform itself? You see, if the Reformation, 16th century, was more or less a gospel reformation, I think it was, theologically. Do we ever have any attempts from the church? We don't try to be the state, but the church has to be related to society, you see. That's what we're talking about here, social justice. Where does the church stand in social justice?